I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and thank you for joining the Magazine Show podcast brought to you by Golster, the experts in health and well-being, with a range of fascinating guests who stimulate, educate, and make us laugh.
Hello, I'm Humphrey Hawksley. This is the Golster Magazine Show, and welcome to our growing podcast audience and to our very special live audience who will chip in, ask questions, and hold us to account, as they say. Today, we are lucky enough to have with us a guest who knows everything about breathing. What, we might say? What are we actually talking about when we mention breathing? Yes, that's something that we do several times a minute, often without thinking, and if we don't do it, we die, and if we do it properly, we feel much better. My guest is the chair of the British Council for Yoga Therapy. He teaches breathing around the world, and his book is Breath for Health, A Mindful Way to Restore Your Natural Breathing Cycle. Welcome, Michael Hutchinson, to the Golster Magazine Show.
Thank you so much. And I'm very pleased to be here and to talk about my favorite subject, breathing.
It is great to have you here. And I'm going to ask you a question. People are going to say, well, that's a really stupid question. But here we go. Michael, what is breathing?
Well, every 12 times a minute, we need to somehow ventilate our bodies to lose carbon dioxide and to gain oxygen to sustain what is basically a very slow process of combustion that takes place within the cells of the body, converting glucose, for example, into energy. And we need oxygen for this.
Okay, so we breathe, that brings in the oxygen, that goes into our blood, that flows around our body, rejuvenating, and flows up to our brain, of course, so that we can think.
Very handy.
Very handy. Just go through that in a little bit more detail of what actually happens to our body when we breathe, and then what happens if we don't.
So it occurred to me last night that our perception is that the breath is coming in and expanding the body. That perception is fine. The physics is the opposite. The outer wall of the body, the chest expands. There's a thing called the diaphragm inside the body, which presses down, nor creates more space for the lungs. The lungs are there ready to receive oxygen, give up carbon dioxide. Then that oxygenated blood goes to the right side of the heart and the left side of the heart, then throws it out into the body. And so it goes into all those millions of tiny vessels going to every part of the body, to receive the oxygen and to give up their carbon dioxide. And all this works the time that we're awake or asleep, whether we're conscious of it or not.
It's a natural thing of the body. And then one of the very common phrases that we have is, you know, being out of breath or being breathless. That's when we're working too hard, is it, to get enough oxygen in there?
Well, when there's, say, we're engaging in a lot of activity, that means that we're burning up glucose, and more carbon dioxide appears in the bloodstream. And when this happens, we feel the discomfort, and it's the discomfort sensing too much acidity in the blood caused by carbon dioxide that causes us to want to breathe more and to sometimes to feel breathless if we feel that we're not keeping up with that.
Oh, okay. But it's actually quite good for you, isn't it? For the up the heartbeat, the coronary exercise and that, and to puff a bit.
Well, I think that all systems in the body, we have this simple principle of use it or lose it. We need to have a margin of capability for a healthy life, so that some small stress doesn't leave us in an estate of wreckage.
Mm. Yes, keep it. So I want to now move on to some stunning statistics or figures that you have in your book. Approximately 6 to 12% of the population here in the UK experience chronic breathing pattern disorders, and some people are more affected by others. And based on those percentages, millions of people who could be helped to better health through breathing exercises, and we're going to go on to that a bit, and breathing patterns and that sort of thing. That is what you teach, isn't it? You teach people to breathe properly.
This is what I find, is that it seems that most of us, by the time we get into our teenage years, have somehow adopted some kind of mildly or less mildly dysfunctional way of habitual breathing. The thing that we have as human beings, we have a lot more control over our breathing than most animals, but there's a downside to this, in that I'm not sure how it happens. It can happen through trauma. It can even happen through copying other people and the way they breathe unconsciously. We tend to be mimics. But also, I've met people who've received instruction, you know, for example, not to use their tummies when they breathe, and which is a natural thing to do. So again, from their teens, they're set off in life with this disadvantage in the way that they breathe.
From the teens, we start breathing badly, and then people of our generation, Michael, then if we have been breathing badly all that time, it would have an impact on us, wouldn't it?
Well, Dr. Claude Lum, working at Papworth Hospital near Cambridge, I heard him speak on the BBC in 1988, towards the end of his career. And by that time, his colleagues at Papworth were sending him patients with all sorts of inexplicable symptoms. And Dr. Lum could quite often help these people by teaching them the simplest of breathing exercises, just say, breathe in for 4 seconds, out for seven, in for four, out for seven. Something as simple like that, and that could very often bring about a lessening of their symptoms.
Briefly, I wonder if that's sitting with all the GPs that have got the queues of waiting lists. Now, you are going to show us in a moment some of these exercises and explain them to us, but I want to go a little bit into your background, because you were a physicist to begin with, and then you took an interest in yoga for the sake of your own health. So what was wrong with you then? And now you're the chair of the British Yoga Therapy Council. So give us that journey, Michael.
Well, certainly, Humphrey. Back in the early 1970s, I realized that I was pretty much inadept at personal relationships. And importantly, I wasn't going to buy myself a partner and get married and so on, you know, if I was such an idiot. So I began to study the science of personal relationships and how to understand people. And that's really the start. And that led me into, I spent some time in a school of Buddhism. But then, you know, I'd been married a few years, and my wife noticed I was getting out of shape, and so she suggested that we go to a yoga class. Now, I toyed with yoga in my teens, but somehow there weren't any classes. I let it slip. And then I found that, you know, I was the one who took to yoga, and not so much my wife, though she does a bit now under my instruction, which is quite an achievement.
And from that, you you became a, what is it? It's I was going to say, sorry, a black belt in yoga. I mean, you rose to the top of the craft.
Well, I was very lucky, Humphrey. In 1983, the teacher I'd been going to, she retired. And I thought, I don't know what I'm doing. She wants me to take over the class. So I managed to find a course run by the British Wheel of Yoga, teacher training. And the tutor, she was connected to, through her teacher, to a man called TKV Desikachar, who was teaching in what was then called Madras, in India. And he was the son of the now legendary Tirumala Krishnamacharya, who often considered the father of modern yoga. So I was very lucky to become part of this sort of really as an ancient and very well-founded tradition in yoga that is a sort of has a complete grasp of the subject so far as we're able to in these times.
So you mentioned Madras, or Chennai as it's called now, this sort of sure. India thing. And I think there was people talk about yoga in Tibet and all this sort of Eastern stuff, which is intricately tied in, isn't it, with this Sanskrit, which is now a dead language, but is very much alive in your area. And you had a word in the book saying this, it was talking about mental clarity, which we're going to get onto in a minute. The Sanskrit word for mental clarity is viveka. So what is it that's so important about Sanskrit and the yoga?
The importance of Sanskrit, Humphrey, is that, you know, Sanskrit was for India like Latin was for medieval and early modern Europe. Because, you know, India itself is a patchwork of peoples and languages. So that's why these important texts were often composed in Sanskrit. And then the outcomes is that, you know, working in this language, teaching and practicing this language, people develop concepts, like we have concepts in medicine that are these days expressed in Latin. These concepts that need some study for people to get a full grasp of them, they're expressed in Sanskrit, and some of them have no sort of exact equivalents in the English language.
Okay, so it's a bit like when we get a Latin word that drops into our language. Sure. It was that sort of thing, just as you said. And do you speak Sanskrit, or do you just know the yoga relevancy of it?
I probably know Sanskrit only a little bit better than most doctors know Latin.
I like that for an answer. This is great. So we're sort of grounded now in yoga, of which there is the physical side of it and the mental clarity side. The Sanskrit word is viveka. I was going to put that as a Goldster quiz question, but I thought that was far too out. Too many people would be reaching for Google on that one. We also mentioned just before we came on air the mindfulness aspect of yoga. Before you describe that, just explain your concept, or what is mindfulness?
Mindfulness is the idea that we're aware of what we're doing when we're doing it, and also that to some extent we're aware of the consequences of what we're doing when we're doing it. And so there is an example that I've often given is, now I want to saw a piece of wood to an exact length and nicely squared off end. So while I'm sawing that piece of wood, that's where my attention is in the cut. I'm not thinking about the rest of the work that piece of wood is going to go into. I'm not thinking about what I'm going to have for lunch. My attention is there in the cut, And if I keep my attention in there, then the cup will come out straight.
Good. Okay. That is, I think, one of the clearest examples of mindfulness. I think I would be dreadful at it because, as you were saying that, I was wondering if anybody's mentioned anything in the chat about what we're talking about. And I have to say now, if you've got any questions about yoga, breathing, mindfulness, Michael is the man to ask. So put it in the chat and we will interrupt whatever we're talking about to do this. And we're going to go through the book in a minute. And I think I've put in the chat the book. I really like that definition too, says Gita. Thank you, Gita. And that's it. And you've got a number of elements going down there. But give us, firstly, you said you'd give an example of mindfulness exercise.
Sure. I put this actually on Instagram a couple of weeks ago. But people, please watch, and then I'll explain to you what I'm doing. So what you saw was, as I breathed in, I took my hands apart. As I breathed out, I got my hands together again. But more than that, when my hands were here, I was finishing breathing out and starting to breathe in. And when my hands were here, I was finishing breathing in and starting to breathe out. This is something Mr. Daisy Gachar taught us, which he called breath longer than movement. The whole point, Humphrey, is that I've been working with this for decades, and I still find that I cannot do this on autopilot. I cannot let my mind wander off. If my mind wanders off, then breathing and moving go into lockstep. Start together, begin together. This, I think, that's one of the most simple mindfulness exercises that I can show people, because I think it opens the door to practice of mindfulness, possibly for people who've perhaps been put off the subject previously.
So your mind is on where your hands are and what they're doing together with your breathing, and that's one thought.
Yes, your mind has to stay with your hands, has to stay with your breathing, otherwise you lose it.
Right. That is fantastic. We are about to go through the exercises or the chapters of the book. But before that, Amber, I think it is, has asked a question. And given Goldster, we will answer it if we can. Yes, fine. Breathing exercises are important, beneficial, but struggle with having a very dry nose. Any tips or advice would be most appreciated.
Well, first of all, I don't know the environment which you're in and whether, for example, the air is very dry. If this is a persistent problem in spite of being in a more humid atmosphere, then provided you're in a relatively warm place, I would suggest there are a way I describe in my book of breathing in through your mouth and out through your nose. So if you're capable of rolling your tongue like this, breathe in through the rolled tongue, close your mouth, and breathe out through your nose. Okay. I've done this on long plane flights.
Marvelous. Amber, I hope that helps answer your question. I just put in Michael's book again and the context. And then Celia says, breathing practice is really good. They can reduce stress and even reduce blood pressure. Michael has reminded me I need to get back to it. So we've already had one tick in the box, and we're going to get right to that right now. So there are more messages coming in, but I'll be mindful about what I'm doing and go to it. Okay, so chapter one, breathing is not a lost art. What do you mean by that?
Well, this really is a gentle riposte to James Nestor's book, Breathe, The New Science of a Lost Art, because much as I admire Nestor's investigative journalism and the way that he is prepared to experiment on himself, I thought, it's not a lost art. I've been taught this art starting 40 years ago. So that's one of the things that is said to me, no, I must write a book. I must get this out there.
Yes. That's your chapter is really a pushback against people who are sort of denigrating what you're advocating.
Well, not so much denigrating it as I'm afraid ignoring it.
Right. Because, ignoring the importance of it, which we're getting from some of our audience, because we have another one in here that's, if I can find it. Oh, we've got lots in here, but I'll just do one at a time here. Sue Townley, how do you find if your breathing pattern is good or bad?
Well, first of all, there may be obvious things, like you may, if you're prone to panic attacks, that's an obvious sign. If you find that you're forgetting to breathe, if you find that you're sighing a lot, these are indications of an habitual dysfunctional breathing pattern. Also, other things, you will find yourself more prone to certain aches and pains, the neck, shoulders, and back, because there is so much of such a strong connection between the way you breathe and your posture of the body.
Okay. So that's it's really, if you've got symptoms that indicate that you could be not breathing well, you should just take note of it. Are you picking something up to show us, Michael?
No, I meant to put my phone away out of the room, and it.
You're not being mindful, you see. You've got to concentrate on what we're talking.
Thank you.
We have, I think this is the first sort of exercise one. Exhale slowly. You gave us some sort of figures earlier on about 3 seconds in, 7 seconds out. Well, what does exhaling slowly mean?
I have a student with COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder. And so obviously I looked into, what is the medical advice given to people with this condition? And one of the things they are told to do if they become breathless is to breathe out more slowly, and you think that's counterintuitively. If they're breathless, they need to breathe faster. But in fact, breathing out more slowly gives your lungs more of a chance to grab that oxygen and release that CO2 and make something out of the breath that you've taken in.
Okay.
Breathing out slowly is not only more efficient, it's more effective, it's more relaxing.
Is there a breathing out slowly example you can give us, as opposed to what we're doing now, which I presume is breathing normally?
Well, one of my concerns, Humphrey, is that people might come from a state of mouth breathing, which is clearly a dysfunctional breathing pattern in its own right. So one of the things that if people find it difficult to start breathing through their noses again, because you all start that way as young children, is to breathe out through pursed lips.
Okay.
So that's a start. There is a technique in yoga called by various names. Scientifically, it's called resistance breathing. People call it ocean breath. They call it the Darth Vader breath, where you learn to make a soft sound in your throat as you breathe out and slow your breath down that way. That has the advantage of taking the pressure off the nose. And then if you learn to do that, you find that you can use your nose for breathing more easily. It has all to do with the fluid dynamics of the airflow in the various passages.
So just to clarify, we should all the time breathe in through our nose and out through our mouth?
No, you breathe all the time, breathe out through your nose.
In and out through the nose, and the mouth is eating and talking.
Exactly. Okay. Yes.
Eating, talking, and kissing occasionally, we could say, should we?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Number three, learn to pause.
We live in a very busy and impatient world. One of the things that the exercises with breathing can do for us, so as I say in Breath for Health, just 10 minutes a day, is learning to pause between breaths. Now, as someone called Patrick McEwen has shown, learning to pause between breaths can be very important for people who suffer from asthma. And Mr. Davis Kachar would have said the same, that for people who suffer from asthma, this is definitely very much between any kind of crisis or an attack, is to learn and to practice to pause, and then that will improve their resistance to asthma attack.
Okay. And the pauses, this is different to holding your breath. This is your after breathing out, you pause.
Thank you for clarifying. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It is the pause between out breath and in breath.
Okay. But something else you said there, and I think you're saying, is that we all lead such busy lives now that generally pausing is a good thing to do occasionally, whether you're breathing or whether you're catching the bus or whatever.
Sort of a pause for thought.
Yes.
In terms of mindfulness, I find that the pause now on empty between out and back in again is a very good time to start practicing the idea of inner silence, of breaking into distracting patterns of thought. Just breathe out, just pause on empty silence for a moment. Just take a break.
Take a break. And in technicalities, you pause, 5 seconds, is it, you would not breathe in for? Or?
Well, Patrick McEwen said that you need to build up the capacity that more or less at the drop of a hat, you could pause your breathing for 20 seconds.
My God. Okay. All right.
But people who suffer from asthma, he says, find 2 seconds can be difficult.
Okay, that's 20 seconds. Are we, Surya, I think it's Surya said this, is we're going back to the Sanskrit now with her comment. According to the Bhagavad Gita, there are 4 ascending stages of yoga: Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Astanga Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. How is your idea compared to this? Is that a familiar to you, Michael, or not?
It is very familiar. Thank you, Suri. So, as I understand it, The Indian subcontinent, up to about 1,000 years ago, was a relatively peaceful place and a very sort of stable socially and politically, which meant that, you know, it wasn't so difficult for people to set up schools of meditation, and explore, you know, the potential for spells of deep meditation. In a new period of Indian history, with more invasions and more disruption, people needed something to help them to address, to get as far as they're having the state of mindfulness to be able to practice these things. And this is why a more physical form of yoga called Hatha Yoga emerged. And this is what most people think of when they think about yoga. They think about sort of looking in through the door, the window in a yoga class, and they see people doing exercises. They see people with their bodies in different positions. But this is actually preparatory. And so the yoga was really introduced to the West by a man called Swami Vivekananda. And he appeared at the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893 and caused a furore. And he was the one who classified these different schools of yoga, Bhakti, Jnana, Raja, okay, and Jnana. And I, sorry to disagree, but I don't actually see, and I don't think Vivekananda saw these as having a progression in themselves, but being, some people would be more attuned. So Karma Yoga, for example, and I love Vivekananda's book of that type, called Karma Yoga, is about the yoga of living in the world and being of service to one's family, one's community, humanity, and learning yoga through selfless action.
So it's a lot more than, as you said, you know, doing, and even I remember these things, the plow and the lotus and these positions that probably all have Sanskrit names. Chapter 4, open your heart.
So 40 years ago and more, someone said to me, Michael, now I can just take 6 breaths and I can be in a different state of mind. And she showed me this, and it meant nothing to me really at the time. I was intrigued. We all have the potential to feel more openness of heart through learning to focus on our breathing in a certain way.
Sorry, just to clarify, so you're talking about our sort of spiritual heart as opposed to our coronary heart?
Well, it's a mixture of the two, really, Humphrey. We can start by imagining, maybe sensing, that we can feel the breath coming in between the breastbone and the heart, okay, which are now talking about physical things. In doing so, we inevitably, with practice, connect with something more subtle at this level. We inevitably contact the idea of feeling more open at heart, more in an emotional or a spiritual sense. So this is one way in which sort of mindful breathing exercises can take us into new places.
Okay, that's where I now I'm with that, and in fact I can just see that how that unfolds. We have, I'm going to throw a quick question in here before we move on. From Linda, can sleep apnea be improved with breathing? What is sleep apnea?
So sleep apnea is when someone who's asleep will actually stop breathing for anything up to a minute. And then suddenly the whole system wakes up, perhaps including the sleeper, and there's sort of some gasp of breath. And if this happens repeatedly, it's not very good for the system because you're actually could get into a state of oxygen deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I have to be careful here talking in terms of medical science, because I think that I would like there to be a proven link between engaging persistently in breathing exercises and not suffering from sleep apnea. But I think that there's more study to be done.
But if you are breathing properly or better than probably all of us or myself is breathing now, then you're less likely to get it. The body is surely less likely to, you know, stop breathing and shut everything down.
I think we can say that, but I can't really think, Humphrey, we're yet at the stage where you can say that, no, we have the yoga breathing exercises that can prevent sleep apnea.
Yeah.
We're not at that stage.
Now, you'll get all those doctors with all that equipment and all those drugs to sell us that would that would tell us that we're wrong. Hips above the heart. What on earth is that, hanging upside down?
Well, Lily, the classical example of a yoga inversion is a headstand, and I used to do a lot more of these when I was younger. What these semi-inversion practices can do, if one practices them with awareness of breathing, is they can have a strengthening effect on the breath. The respiratory diaphragm is a muscle like any other muscle. And when we are inverted, it has to work harder. It has to work against gravity to push the abdominal organs upwards. And so other writers like Patrick McEwen and particularly John Douyard, author of the book Body, Mind and Sport, and the classic in the field, they talked about diaphragm fatigue that can take place even in athletes.
Okay. So we should, all, even if we're not going to stand on our head, it doesn't do us any harm to sort of prop ourselves up so that our hips are above our heart for 10 minutes and read a book or something?
Maybe. And some people counsel things like sandbag breathing, but I would just say, you know, arrange yourself as I show in Breath for Health. You have you're lying, you have your feet up on the chair, and you have some padding, some thick padding under your hips, so your hips are a little bit above your heart, and that makes your diaphragm work a little bit harder than usual. And it also helps with your circulation. It gives your heart a bit of a rest, because it then means that your breathing will then take over part of the work of circulation of the blood.
Good goodness, I'm not going to suggest that somebody with apnea does that, because we will get. But it sounds that it's sort of strengthening the muscles inside, and all sort of different posture, as it were. Counting slowly.
Sure. What we can do, once we have sort of mastered the basic arts of working with breath, is to start to breathe, use different breathing exercises for different effects. Now, there is an idea that all breathing exercises in yoga are relaxing. That's clearly not the case. some of the ancient practices were clearly designed to be quite stimulating. And so by, for example, you know, instead of, say, breathing in for four and out for seven, we can say breathe in for six, out for six. More time spent breathing in signals that we're going in, that we're wanting to go into a more active state.
Right. Okay.
Time we spend breathing out, the signals we are into a relaxing state. More time spent breathing in, the association with the sympathetic nervous system and being ready for activity.
Okay, six in, six out. You had me doing that whilst you were saying it. So because we are running short of time for our podcast listeners, I'm going to ask you the last one, and then we can see if we can get another question in. Clear and calm. Now, chapter number seven.
Humphrey, you introduced this idea of viveka, of clarity. Mr. Deshkachar was always talking about this. The world is full of knowledge. We have the internet, we have the web, we're awash with information. What we seem to lack in these times is the capacity to stand back and get some clarity about the situations that we face and the situations that face the world. So I thought it was important to put in some things about that.
Okay, so clarity, if we are clear about something, we are calmer.
This is the idea. This is a surprising thing when I first started to study in this tradition. You know, when there's clarity, there's no pressure to act.
Yes.
The idea that all the time that we are in, it's like a hurried mode of existence, of operation. We often don't see the wood for the trees. We often become too involved in something to the extent of forgetting what's important. But clarity, the capacity to pause, enables us to stand back.
Yes.
And see things more clearly. In which case, we think, well, why are we rushing around? There's a better way of doing this.
Yes, I think that's great. You have your last chapter is going forward. Could you encapsulate that for us?
What I would like to see, there are others in the UK who are more involved in the initiative to take yoga into healthcare, both from two angles. One is to help the healthcare professionals to look after themselves. And now, as we know, many of them are under a lot of stress and could be very well motivated if they knew something simple and effective to help them to approach their work with more calm and clarity. The other direction is to take yoga into mental health units, because there is a great deal of potential there. Because when I spoke about Hatha yoga earlier, one of the principles of Hatha yoga is to have, when the breath is disturbed, the mind is disturbed. When the breath is settled, the mind is settled.
Yes.
That's a pivotal phrase in the text.
I'm going to leave our podcast listeners with that thought because I like that very much and it's simple. For those with us live, stay on. We are going to end our podcast recording now and then open it up to the floor. Yes, and find out more of our podcast by Googling Golster Podcast. You can hear Peter Hacker, he's our Golster philosopher about what is human. Sir Anthony Seldon, Golster's favorite headmaster and happiness expert. Nigel Crisp, who used to run the NHS. Let's ask him if he would have allowed yoga into the NHS, because I think your point is so valid there. Lord Richard Dannett, who used to run the army, and many more. Do the soldiers on the front lines know about what we've been talking about? Thank you, Michael Hutchinson. Do check out the book Breath for Health and click on to www.breathforhealth.yoga. And come back again, Michael, because you have so much to share with us. Thank you for this Golster podcast and goodbye.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to a Golster Magazine Show podcast. Check us out on www.golster.co.uk. We hope to tempt you, your family, and friends into the exciting world of helping everyone live healthier and happier for longer. Find more podcasts just by Googling Golster and podcast. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, and hope you're with us again soon.